Tamsin Ebelton is an attachment-based psychotherapist and the director of the Music Industry Therapist Collective, or MITC. She has worked as a music promoter, tour manager, and artist manager for 10 years prior to shifting her focus to therapy, and she has recently published Touring and Mental Health, the Music Industry Manual. We are so thrilled to welcome her to Sober Sex.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got it, spiritual growth. Sober Sex, all of this and more. Sober Sex, you'll never get bored. Sober Sex, all of this and more. Sober Sex, we're never ever bored. Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, and mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got it, spiritual growth. Sober Sex, you'll never get bored. Sober Sex, all of this and more. Sober Sex, you'll never get bored. Sober Sex, all of this and more.
And we're live. But yeah, it seems like you're kind of on the tail end of the book tour, as it were.
Yeah.
Is that one of the reasons why you're kind of glowing quietly?
I think so. Yeah, it's been quite a lot. I mean, you know, it's a great opportunity and things. But yeah, I'm looking forward to a break. So it's kind of the tail end. But I feel like a lot of the sort of interviews that are happening now are ones with people who I've met before, and I feel much more comfortable with them. So like today, I mean, I was just thinking, you know, actually, this doesn't feel like I have to sort of remember. I mean, I of course I do have to remember. Yeah, exactly. Which I'm really crap at. So it's much better when it's, you know, just people connecting and talking. That's easier.
Awesome. Well, I'm happy that you feel relaxed here with me today. And likewise, it's really nice to see you. And are you talking to us, the, you know, Royal We from London today?
Yes. Southeast London. Yeah.
Lovely. And so for those listeners, we tried to record this like pre-Easter. And then my technology was really bad because there was like a storm.
Yeah.
So we couldn't finish the interview. So Tamsin has very generously agreed to kind of come back on and retry the interview, but I hope it's been enough time that you've like forgotten the answers. It feels fresh.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that we had a force majeure. Majeure, how do you say it? You're in France, you can probably help me.
I think it's majeure, right, but I could be wrong because my French is still not the great. But yes, it was like, you know, a godly catastrophe outside of our control prevented the last recording. So here we are. And just to remind us, what are your pronouns?
They are she, her.
Awesome. Same. And, you know, our kind of Sober Sex anchor question, because I think unless people are in like a gender non-conforming or trans space, they don't often get to like think about this stuff. I wonder, what is your experience of gender today?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, today I'm going to Seetal's wedding later. So, I know, I'm so excited. Honestly, that's probably also why I'm feeling so happy today. Like,
yeah.
Get to go to a party and celebrate. But it's a really good question. And, you know, I think most often I feel quite privileged in that I don't think about it an awful lot unless I'm thinking about fertility. There are some times where I think it has influenced how somebody's talking to me. So there's some times where, I don't know, maybe your point of view isn't considered as valuable, let's say, in certain scenarios. That happens less and less now. It's not completely.
Awesome.
Yeah, I feel very lucky. I mean, you know, as a therapist, there can sometimes be a bias, a positive bias towards women therapists. Sometimes more people feel comfortable opening up. But I think people would perhaps say that there are biases within academia, certainly, and within psychoanalytic theory. I guess that's not personal to me. So yeah.
No, but it's interesting though, because you do come from like a music industry background, and I assume that it was quite a different experience when you were working in those contexts as it is to psychotherapy.
Yeah, I mean, without going into details, I mean, it would vary from, let's say, people assuming that I was the secretary taking the minutes in meetings where I was you know, an artist manager or something, or had more clout, let's say, to, I mean, sexual assault, which I don't really talk about, but, you know, there was certainly, it was certainly more in the room then, I would say. But I'm hoping things are changing in some areas in music. I know there's a long, long way to go, but, you know, being aware of more kind of harassment training on tour, things like that. You know, we talk a little bit in the book actually about women feeling that there were barriers to job progression in certain roles, you know, harassment on the road and casual sexism and pay disparity and things like that, which we really did want to talk about. I feel quite privileged that I'm not subject to that myself. You know, I get to set my own rates, and I think they're probably actually, if anything, on the higher side. But yeah, so
I mean, but that's really exciting that even, you know, to have like a published material that is research backed that like talks about it and kind of at least kind of introduces the idea of protocols that might be useful for people who are experiencing that stuff, or even how to kind of like, you know, obviously I do think that like sexism or misogyny and mental health are definitely linked, especially in an area that is so lacking in equity, yeah, as the music industry. So you mentioned the book, and obviously like we're here to at least in part to talk about the book. So congratulations even belatedly on the release of Touring and Mental Health, the Music Industry Manual.
Thank you.
And can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to publish the book?
Yeah, so I realized the other day, because I'm going to New York in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to meet the woman who was the clinical editor, because we're on a panel over there. And I realized when I first met her, it was December 2018. And this is a woman called Paula Thompson. She does a lot of research in creativity and trauma, which is very interesting. Yeah,
should talk to her.
Yeah, she's fascinating. She'd be a great person to talk to, actually. I started thinking I wanted to write the book based on research I conducted in 2016 to 2018. And that was MA research on the psychological impact of touring. And I interviewed 4 musicians, UK-based musicians, about their experiences on tour, and started to pulling together these kind of threads of what was and wasn't said on tour, what, you know, common stresses are, what the impact of relationships can be. And from there, I realized, you know, doing my research, there really wasn't much out there. There was some prominent research studies, one in particular, the Gross, I don't know how to pronounce her name, Sally Gross, I suppose it is. Yeah, Sally Gross and George Musgrave, with Help Musicians, did this huge study that is often cited, called Can Music Make You Sick? And there'd been previously some research, but there hadn't really been anything that looked at touring. There has been now, and actually in the course of that, there was a guy called Paul did some research on the here we go, you know.
It's cool.
I don't have a mind for remembering like song lyrics or titles, and so research studies.
I can only remember song lyrics, but never people's names.
Got it.
So Paul.
Yeah, Paul, great guy. So Paul Paul did some research on crew experiences on the road, and then we've had some later research as well by Chaim Newman and co in the States, which was artists and crew. So basically there is more research now, but there certainly wasn't any advice really.
Or like how to kind of apply the research in ways that could actually be useful to people who are experiencing what the research was researching.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I think that that's a wider trend really, is that we have a lot of research about mental health in the music industry now. There's certainly some gaps, but there's a lot of research about mental health and music. But there hasn't been much kind of solid, nothing much by way of kind of psychoeducation, here's what to do. And my experience on the road had been, so it was mainly in live booking festivals and clubs, venues, for about 12 years all in all, and went out on the road, and I realised that I'd kind of quite severely underestimated the impact of touring on my mental health. At that point I was in therapy, so I was like, I think I'll be fine, like it's good. And I'd subscribe to some of the more romanticized ideals and just underestimated just the impact of being away from home, which I'm not someone that gets homesick at all. In fact, I'm someone who's quite independent in that way, but just the familiarity of knowing where to get your favorite foods, or the familiar foods, or, you know, that sense of, you know, being able to get around and liaise with people in your mother tongue, and just the ordinary things we take for granted. And it's obviously a lot more.
And the mental load of not necessarily having those things accessible for, you know, months or weeks at a time.
Yeah, exactly. Mental load's a really important word. For what happens on tour, because it's a cumulative stress experience. It hits your body, it hits your mind, it hits your relationships, and you've got, you know, and some parts of it that I quite enjoy, like the problem solving on the fly thing, quite like that. You know, you're like, oh, fuck, what have I got? You know, something happens and you've got to phone a person who knows a person, or, you know, there's lots of moving parts. I quite like that, but it takes a toll. And, you know, just sleep, not being able to switch off, your body clock is adjusting to this different time, you know, and certainly if you're DJing, you know, some of the sets people are doing that are like the prime time sets can be really early in the morning, you're sleeping through the day, so your circadian rhythm and your melatonin production's all fucked, essentially, it's a clinical word. And you know, it's just, it hits you in lots and lots of different ways, as you know. And so, yeah, so that's why I wanted to write the book, essentially.
No, and I think it's such a useful, like, especially because it is the first of its kind, essentially. And because there is, it, like, there, again, you said there's research, but not necessarily kind of a practical application. I wonder how you decided what to include, just because, like, touring can look really different to a lot of different people, whether in, you know, the challenges of, for instance, like live touring with a band are very different from the challenges of, you know, touring as a DJ independently, or, you know, being part of a crew where your needs might be met in a different way than, like, if you're a, you know, arena headliner. Like, how did you kind of choose the subject matter? Cause it's so intense.
I'd love to say that there was a plan. there was no plan. I guess we went for the broad strokes in a way. So, and that's one of the things that, so most people tend to say this really resonated. But, you know, I guess there are different, of course, there are different ways to tour. It's different if you're touring, you know, on your own. They could, you know, there can be loneliness and isolation. You're trying to navigate a lot of stuff on your own, or in a small group compared to a big group where you're, you know, a small village on the road, and conditions of touring can be very different. If you're in a splitter van to you're in a bus to, as you say, yeah, depending
on the PJ.
Yeah. and different, you know, if you're sort of trying to gain success, trying to maintain success, you're kind of plateauing somewhere, you're, you know, all of these different sort of things mean that actually touring is quite hard to measure in lots of ways. So one of the things I wanted to do at some point, which I haven't done, but if anyone's out there and they want to do this, please do, is about kind of really getting into what are the different, not the different factors, but it's essentially measuring stress on tour through cortisol saliva tests. So measuring somebody's usual base rate at home, and then as the tour progresses at different times in the day, and just having that kind of map of actually what is the stress impact to the body? Because we know, you know, everything's self-reported at the moment, I think, what people are mainly focusing on. And I'd like to see, I mean, you could do it even more sort of medical than that. You could do, you know, like, you know, when you see sort of, I don't know, a documentary on the telly and they do like a health test before and then they put them on some radical diet and then they do it after. We could do that for touring and see, like, you know.
I love this idea so much, because I do think that also, like, the self-reporting is really challenging, because not unlike, you know, without a specific kind of baseline of performance testing, it must be really challenging, because, like, even if my body feels super run down, but I feel euphoric after a show, like, those things are not necessarily correlational to, like, you know, how I feel when I go to bed and how I feel when I wake up might be night and day. So, like, it really depends on when you ask the questions and, like, what's going on. Like, if you catch me in the airport, like, having missed a flight, it's a very different response than if you catch me like right before or after I go on stage, right?
Exactly.
And I just got this, I'm so obsessed with it, a new smartwatch for like running and training.
Right.
And it measures stress in terms of like training readiness and also just kind of like sleep and respiratory rate and VO2.
Right.
And I wonder, like, I got it like the beginning of the week, so I haven't played shows with it yet,
right.
But I'm really excited to be like, how does this, what does this look like on a kind of a, because I have a pretty clear idea of like when I am on the road, I don't really sleep. Like it goes from like 7 hours a night to like 2 hours a night.
Right.
But I'm so curious to see kind of how that like
yes
affects the body in a way of like recovery and heart rate and, you know.
Well, I think that is it. Yeah, exactly. Heart rate variability. I think what the smartwatches would be a great way to do it, actually. That would be probably a much simpler way to do it. I think it'd be nice to measure cortisol too. And I think, you know,
fascinating.
Partly what you're describing as well is that, you know, it's certainly around performance. There are a lot of other hormones involved as well and neurotransmitters that can make you feel really great and can, you know, can be sort of stress relievers, like endorphins are a stress reliever, right? Which is why you get runners high and that helps you keep going. And, you know, it's part of what's happening on stage with lots of other hormones
for
as
sure.
well. And it might not be till later that you really realize, oh God, you know, you start to get the impact of actually the stress that your body's been through. So it can be, we call it eustress. So like euphoria, you being, you know, eustress or distress. So it's positive stress, but it's still a stress. And that's the thing. And I think, you know, I was certainly guilty of, you know, maybe sort of I'm thinking about when I was managing artists, which I only did for a couple of years, really, and I wouldn't say it was at any particularly professional level. But I think that I could see the positives, and maybe wanted to encourage an appreciation of the positives without really understanding the toll that it took. And I think I have a much greater understanding of that. I mean, I did in a performed a little bit when I was younger, and performance anxiety was so destructive for me. Destructive is not the right word. It was so prevalent that I just stopped performing. So I kind of understood the anxiety of it, but I didn't understand what it's like when you, okay, we look at, I'm rambling a little bit, but.
No, not at all. It's a long form podcast. Go off.
Brilliant. So when, I guess, you know, some of the research before we looked at touring was looking at performance individually, and one piece of research said, you know, when you're playing music at home, it's cortisol reducing, so we assume that that's stress relieving, cortisol being a stress hormone. So I should state the obvious, but the minute that you play in front of a crowd, and this is regardless of how experienced you are and how big the crowd is, it's cortisol increasing. Now it might also increase other hormones that I don't know,
balance it out in a positive way,
right? Right. But then if you're anxious, say you've got somebody who isn't a very anxious performer or has an amount of stress that they feel is manageable and tolerable, and you have someone that has a level of stress which is unmanageable and intolerable for them, they haven't learned strategies around that, then they are both going to have a cortisol increase, but one will be much higher, which, you know, is maybe a bit obvious. But what we now think, just to extend that, it's
no.
So that was looking at one performance, and now we're thinking about what happens when you compress all these performances together, and how, you know, that cortisol is going to impact how you sleep, as is, you know, the impact to your melatonin and the sensory stimulation and any drug use or alcohol or, you know, having a pizza at the end of the show, whatever you're using to self downregulate, which I think is partly what some of that stuff's for. As well as celebrating and all the rest of it, you know, that's all going to impact your sleep as well. So as you say, most people, they're sort of, the benefit of restorative sleep is reduced because they're not sleeping as long, or the quality of sleep's impaired, and then they're waking up in a mild state of stress, probably.
Because you have to travel the next day and figure stuff out.
Right, exactly. And then you might have another show. So it's going to keep, you know, you can see how it builds in that way.
Yeah, totally. And it's interesting too, because I feel like you know, in the electronic music community, most of our shows, because they are so later, tend to be on, you know, Fridays and Saturday nights, occasionally like a Sunday day party or a Thursday night exceptionally. But like, I know in like the live touring, it's often really a, there are possibilities 6 days, 7 days a week to play shows. Mm-hmm. And so then you're traveling every day and you don't have rest days. You don't have a chance to like cook food or do laundry or, you know, it's, right. it's a go, often in really kind of terrible conditions with a lot of financial stress. Mm-hmm. And so I also wonder kind of how, you know, like now with this information on a like research basis plus informed, strategies of how to kind of manage that. I do wonder how one could hopefully help the industry kind of move in that direction. Cause I do feel like AFEM, which is the Association for Electronic Music and Music Cares in the United States and musicians in the UK, like it seems like there are definitely more and more places that have resources to, mm-hmm. to be supportive. But a lot of times I find that, for instance, like we speak on panels about mental health and there's a lot of amazing information, mm-hmm. but it feels, and I'm curious actually as to your sense of this, but like for me, a lot of the times it feels very performative, mm-hmm. like that the industry is like patting itself on the back for like, we're talking about it. You're like, yeah, we've been fucking talking about it for like 10 years. Like what are we doing, you know, as an industry to actually provide resources?
Yeah.
Because like the problems aren't changing if this is the nature of touring, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. I guess where I'm at with that is I see a lot of box ticking.
Yeah.
You know, okay, done. Well, we've sent around this.
Talked about it.
Yeah, talked about it, done. But actually the systemic change, the kind of regulations that might need to come in, or the system, you know, I guess when I'm thinking about systemic change, what am I thinking about? I'm thinking about things like
digital streaming platforms. Yeah. Like, I'll let you know what you're thinking about. Just kidding.
Well, tell me about that in relation to mental health for you.
Well, I mean, I think for me, if you take the financial pressure off of touring as really the sole source of income, mm-hmm. And help artists feel like their worth is meaningful outside, and this gets a little bit kind of complex. It's a complex system, but like, if my worth is valued at streamability, mm-hmm. It means that the more streamable, the more kind of easy listening something is, the more valuable it is. Mm-hmm. Whereas like, if I'm here to make art and not just entertainment, you know, not just like streams for pleasure, then there's a different kind of sense of value about the work I make, mm-hmm. in that am I making something that is just, you know, playable in shopping malls and hair salons, or am I making something that, you know, like for me, the music of other artists that has saved my life, which might not in fact be that streamable because it's more challenging emotionally, right? And if so, like there's this kind of idea of like, how do you value the work, and then how does the value actually translate to money, which I think would alleviate a lot of the pressures of touring if you can really make choices about the conditions in which you're touring and, you know, not kind of panic about even breaking even, because I think that that is a real, especially in the live space, that's a very real concern at this point.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess what I hear in that is about financial security, and it makes me think a little bit about, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think there's, you know, there's revising the way that streaming is paid and how and who's get it, you know, I mean, that's a conversation with the labels as well, because those relationships,
for sure.
You know, is very important. But also,
sorry, I just hijacked this.
No, not at all.
But I'm curious as to your take, because again, like you are the kind of the expert on touring and mental health, and how can we talk about touring and mental health without this idea that if we're touring for money, then
of course,
yeah.
And absolutely, you can make better choices when you're financially secure, and I think a part of that is also about, I mean, one suggestion that somebody made when I interviewed them, Natasha Hendry, who you might have come across, so she researches race in education, racism in education. She's wow. So she is a singing teacher and singer. So she sang for years with Chicane and toured a lot with Chicane. And she was suggesting fee transparency, because so much discrimination can be built into the way that people were paid. And this would come across from lots of people in interviews. There was very high profile men in touring who were saying the fee, some women are paid up to 50% less in certain roles on certain tours. Not all tours are like this. Some tours do have disparity. And the argument against it is, that I hear anyway when I've suggested to people, is often like, oh, that means it's not competitive. But I think you can still have wage bans that people can, you know, have a...
For sure.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of wider ecosystem issues that feedback, both in the kind of literal sort of security sense, and I think I would include health security in that as well, you know.
For sure.
Countries where... So the health system relies on insurance. How is that? And there are systems. In fact, Rhoda Clint's got a relationship that's very cheap sort of insurance in the States. But it's also about value, and how do you, you know, what if you're financially secure, as you say, can you do you then have the freedom to make music that you feel has more integrity or personal value to you? Does it change your relationship with the commercial aspect of your music? Mm. Or does it relate?
Or like... Yeah, why you tour?
Yeah,
you know,
right?
Like, and meaning making.
Yeah, exactly. And how you tour? You know, do you have to tour quite? Do you have to put yourself through quite so much intensity, or can you be more selective? Yeah.
Yeah. No, that it's interesting to kind of like zoom out and have that be part of the conversation, because it is so much more difficult to kind of mm-hmm. like pin down and research, and it is obviously kind of a one that has to be based on self-reporting, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a woman in the States who works, her name, I can't remember her surname now, Rachel, who is a financial advisor that works with Crew. Haven't seen anybody that does that over here yet, but I was looking at Martin Lewis's, he had some financial anxiety, a document that went out on his website in the UK, which I've now forgotten. Is it money something? Money, I want to say Money Supermarket, but I don't think that's right. Anyway, long story short, you know, anxiety around money and having this constant job insecurity of not knowing when your next income stream is coming in or how long it'll be. And yeah, okay, you might get a sink and fantastic, that, you know, saves the day for a few months and you can rest. But living on the edge like that, it is very, very difficult, and it can really eat away at you, constantly having to hustle, you know, the mindset of constantly putting yourself out. And, you know, not that everybody's in that position, but if you are, then yeah, that's going to take a toll.
No, for sure. And I think for, as you mentioned, like for artists and for Crew, if the income is kind of tour dependent. And I also wonder kind of like, for you personally, I know that the response of the industry to this book has been really fantastic, and I wonder what it was like for you to kind of go from the long internal process, kind of the introverted like writing and researching and editing this book, to the kind of outward facing like PR interviews, book tour. Like, what has that process been like for you, especially now that you've kind of, you know, it seems like you're at the end of that.
Well, I was really nervous about doing that. Louisa, I just want to quickly say, I've just had a look at this thing at the bottom that shows our input for the microphone, and mine mm-hmm. looks really small.
I don't know. That's okay.
Is that still picking it up?
Yeah, it's totally picking it up, and I can balance the levels in post.
Okay, cool.
I appreciate your concern.
It's just I've done a few of these where I've thought I've been talking into the mic, and it turns out I haven't, so I just wanted to check. Okay.
No worries at all. Okay. You're good.
Cool. So, I mean, look, I guess I'm a behind-the-scenes person. I'm most comfortable one-on-one with someone in a room talking about them. So talking about me and my process, I'm more comfortable now, you know, I've had a bit of practice now, but yeah, it was really daunting. I don't like being on stage. I don't know how you do it. It's not.
I mean, I don't have to remember any talking points. I just have to scream at people. So how did you kind of support yourself in that transition from kind of introverted to extroverted communication around the book?
Well, I've been in therapy for a very, very long time. Very, very long time. But the therapist I've been with for the past kind of 6 years or so has seen the, actually maybe it's shorter than, maybe it's about 4 years, I think, has been through the process of this with me. So he was very helpful in helping me understand what some of my blocks were around like finishing it. So I'm a perfectionist, working on that continuously. So, you know, getting it to a point where it's out and then talking about something when you don't feel like it's perfect. You know, what do you do when I know it's valuable? I can see that there is useful stuff in there. And it helps me to have collaborated with other people on that, because I feel like I'm sharing the burden of it a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
But in terms of the kind of literal process around, I mean, I wish I'd done some sort of media training in a way. I mean, maybe not, but so I have my therapist.
I think you're doing great.
I just sort of ramble and then realize, oh, fuck, what have I said? But yes, I had hypnotherapy for public speaking anxiety. I can't remember his name now either, but he was fantastic. And I have a little recording that sometimes I listen to. And I don't know how it works, but it did work for me. I was quite skeptical of it, and I was like, I don't feel like I'm being hypnotized, but it is somehow shifting something a little bit in my unconscious, which is exactly what I needed it to do. And just takes the level of affect down slightly so that I can, you know, stay
conscious.
Yeah, and I can think, you know, that's always what we're trying to do, is to try and think and feel at the same time. That's the aim of most therapies.
I like that. I hadn't really heard that, but it definitely tracks. That's really cool. And yeah, I mean, I when I was like competing as a kid in horse shows, like I also had a lot of performance anxiety, and I did hypnotherapy, and it was super helpful.
Right. Yeah.
And you mentioned collaboration, and I know that former Sober Sex guest, Sital Panesar, contributed to the sex and relationships chapter.
Yes.
And I wonder kind of what were some of her findings there, and you know, how you observe that touring dysregulates sexual relationships or behaviors.
Yeah. So in 2020, I interviewed 8 couples, and I wanted to do was speak to people where there'd been one person who goes out on the road and one person who stays at home, and what are the issues that come up for them and how do they navigate them? So a bit of that info was, or the kind of findings was given. So there's a section on relationships in general in the book. So there's a chapter on romantic relationships by Stan Tatkin. There's another chapter on groups and group dynamics, how groups form and function, the sort of roles that people take, what are the sort of phenomena that come up, like a like emotional contagion, the fact that when you're in a tight group and you're traveling and living and working together, then emotions spread like wildfire. Why do they do that? And then what happens? So there's a culture of silence where things are known, issues are known that they're there, but they're not addressed, and that can have a function for keeping your head above water, but it pushes things underground and things like that. But in terms of sex, I wanted to think about you know, what is the impact on not having that physical proximity? You know, we know that from cradle to grave, for most people, this isn't true for everybody, physical touch is very regulating. You know, we know that from skin to skin with mothers and babies. We know it from massage. We know it from various other things. And also, you know, I was aware that some people struggle with sex addiction on the road. You know, they have elevated status if you're on stage anyway. In fact, arguably, if you're anywhere around
the, related,
exactly, you have elevated status, so you have a bit more sense of maybe confidence or erotic power in some way, or more, and people are can be very attracted to that. Some people struggle with self-regulation, and sex addiction and porn addiction can be part of what happens for them. And it's not something that's openly spoken about because there can be a great deal of shame around it. Obviously, it can impact any relationships if that person's in a relationship. So we've got a sex and porn addiction chapter as well. But for Cetal's chapter, what I really wanted to do was, you know, I was thinking, okay, if somebody is having sex on the road, what do they need to know? Well, they need to know about consent. I think that's very important. And active consent and passive consent. They need to know about STIs. So there's, I love the little images on the STIs. Actually, we've got an illustrator, John, and he's like, I remember sending Cetal the, I think it was like the, I'll see if I can get it up.
It's like, how cute is chlamydia?
Yeah, exactly. Like, ooh, this one's quite trippy. And oh, look at this lice. This lice is so cute. Anyway, so I...
Not IRL.
I know, right? Well, yeah, quite. So I wanted people to know how to identify what was happening in their body, you know, what to do about it, where to get help, how to describe it. I also wanted to talk about assault. And it was around the time that there had been this disclosure of a serious assault that happened on tour, and people were talking about that a lot. And I really wanted to for people to understand what assault is, what the legality is around it, where to go for help. Because we also have, you know, people in heightened states. We certainly have power dynamics playing out on the road.
For sure.
We have people in heightened states, either because of this sort of hormonal things that are happening for them or because of substances or whatever.
Totally.
And I think we have people, what else? Well, I think that's enough. I think that's enough for things to happen.
I think there's also like a context thing. Mm-hmm. That because like you don't have the context of like ever necessarily seeing someone again.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the context of like what's going on in either of the parties involved lives, yeah. You know, outside of this kind of one night, one situation. I think it can be also much more challenging to kind of read consent or to like dispel a kind of fantasy.
Right.
The person is essentially can only be a projection.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Like that's confusing.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was coming up in some of the interviews were people saying, you know, speaking with tour managers and people saying there were times where they've, you know, they'd get the gear in, of course, and we would talk a little bit about enabling. And also they would bring sex workers in. You know, this doesn't happen on every tour by any stretch. But the idea, and this is where gender comes in again, but where, you know, there can be an expectation that sex or, you know, hot girls, if we're talking about men, is part of the spoils of war, you know, is part of your reward for being good at your job and for working really hard, you know, that it's kind of tied into the idea of celebration for some people. So also...
Well, I mean, especially like thinking about, like, I thought that the kind of that sex as a kind of like little treat, like currency, was part of the kind of hair metal 80s, like tacky and over. And then you hear about this like Rammstein stuff that are happening, like that there's been allegations against them for kind of grooming people under gross. But that that's not in fact a thing of the past, certainly.
I don't think it is. I mean, you know, I think the horrible thing when I heard about that Rammstein thing was I was absolutely in no way shocked or surprised. I don't want to say too much more on that about what it reveals about my assumptions or my perception of that band, but I wasn't surprised. But yeah, that it does still happen. And I think it happens in other genres and scenes as well.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
And then you have the, I've forgotten the term actually, what's it called? And you have those kind of very intense one-way relationships that, God, there's a phrase for it. Do you know what? I'll have a little look, but you know, you're meeting people who on the road who can idealize you, you know, and
yeah, for sure.
And that can be very intoxicating for both sides. You know, it can be very exciting for the person to meet their, you know, somebody that they really admire and they've elevated, and also for the person who's elevated and feeling a sense of I don't know, superiority.
Godlike power.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, they like being adored. Who doesn't like being adored sometimes, you know? But it's kind of...
No, for sure.
It's that, and that's, you know, part of the power imbalance we talked about earlier.
Yeah, and I do wonder, you know, like how that does mess with consent, and also how it kind of can exacerbate the issues of like dysregulation, like loneliness and, mm-hmm. and feeling like misunderstood or kind of like, you know, I think often sex without, you know, a deeper personal connection or meaning can leave one feeling a little empty and mm-hmm. disturbed,
yeah.
you know, and like, yeah. and then you take that to the next city and it's like, oh God, this is a long nightmare.
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Right. I think, yeah, I've just remembered that phrase or just found it anyway. It's called parasocial relationships, where it's that kind of,
oh, we love a parasocial relationship.
There you go. Yeah, I think it is complex. It's not always as easy to identify who was, the person in power. Sometimes it is, absolutely, but sometimes it's quite complex. Certainly I'm aware of times where fans have been extremely persistent in attempting to seduce, you know, and that, of course, that doesn't then endorse or you know, make anything that happens further anything to do with the fan, it being the fan's fault. I'm not victim blaming here, but I'm just saying that what can happen can be very complex.
Well, and also I think that there can be issues now that we're just only starting to kind of see or talk about, that it's because, again, like obviously on sober sex are very much like hashtag believe women, mm-hmm. but I do think that like issues with and I do sense is gendered in some way, and I think that that's worth noting, but, you know, not always in the same direction. Mm-hmm. But I think like the issues of maybe like having a stalker or feeling like mm-hmm. one is in a precarious position because there was a misunderstanding of what consent looked like in that situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if both people are intoxicated, like those are super complex situations that can really ruin people's lives and careers. So it's like, yes. How do we kind of have some forethought about that now that we're in a post Me Too era? And like, I mean, maybe not post, but like we're in the Me Too era.
Yes.
Around like best practices, you know, of like, what does that look like and how do you kind of make sure everybody's having a good time?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's something about not just kind of consent to sex or a sexual act, but exactly what that looks like.
You know, when we're talking about any kind of like, I guess, like, quote unquote, non-vanilla sex practice, mm-hmm. that a lot of this stuff is very much based in trust and communication, yes. obviously, which, you know, is necessary for consent. Mm-hmm. And if there's a very small window of actual time people are spending together, there's not a lot of time for aftercare. There's not a lot of time for like discussions of what feels safe and like the embodiment of kind of processing information of like, okay, with this person, this feels acceptable in my body. This feels like a little bit like I'd have some anxiety around this because we don't really know each other. Like a lot of that stuff, I think, especially because one or both parties might be intoxicated, might be really, kind of brushed over, right? Or not at all discussed.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, so how to kind of like, even if it, like, and I don't think, you know, quote unquote, one night stands are like meaningless sex, like they can be great sexual experiences for both people, but in order to kind of, how to, again, what are best practices for creating scenarios that are safe and sane and consensual mm-hmm. in any kind of sexual practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I was just scanning through the book to see actually what made it in. But yeah, SSC is the thing to think about there. And how much can you establish a kind of real in-depth knowing of what somebody is comfortable with if the encounter is very brief? You know, there are limitations to that.
Especially because it is, I think, a very temporal thing of like, each time that you meet, you might like raise the stakes a little bit, but if you're meeting one time, then it might mm-hmm. feel like there's some pressure to kind of perform.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And I like alongside sex and rock and roll, drugs are kind of the remaining part of the hedonistic trifecta mm-hmm. that life on the road can entail. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if research shows a growing movement towards recovery. Or if by some miracle people manage to like drink and use in sustainable ways on tour, like I wonder how, what your research shows, and also again, kind of about best practices.
Well, we didn't, I mean, in terms of the sexual health chapter, actually, we had some sections on chemsex. We also had some sections on PrEP and PEP, which I think was very important to include, and what to do if that you have an unwanted pregnancy. But yeah, so the research that I do is not particularly measuring stats. It's more about sitting with the experience of kind of what's going on for that person and looking at trends maybe between. So I interviewed, I think it was like nearly 90 people or something for this. So I think there's generational differences in terms of attitudes towards some drug use, and you know, there are trends that happen, aren't there?
I'm so curious. What are you finding? That's like fascinating.
Well, I don't know whether I would class this as research, but I'm noticing. We do
observational.
We do a lot of noticing in therapy, but you know, say there's a lot of interest in things like ayahuasca. You know, in terms of a way to have a short, deep spiritual experience. For some people it can be helpful, for other people it can be very distressing. It can open something up that then they need to hold in some way. In terms of on the road, my sense is that it is very much still there. There are certainly trends around like amphetamine use for crew who have. So you can understand that if you're thinking about some drug use could be thought of as having a function. I mean, it, you know, certainly psychologically it always has a function, right? But a physical function in artificially inducing states of energy or rest. So you have, you know, typically uppers and downers. Or somebody's trying to find some sort of sweet spot where they feel safe, they feel potent, they have that heightened, you know, experience that maybe they feel connected to people. Maybe those states are hard for people to reach without these additional factors. But maybe, you know, there's also something about how are they trying to regulate their body at different times. And of course, there's, you know, we do know that proximity is you know, one of the factors. If you're and I was certainly guilty of this when I was a promoter, you know, sometimes I would get in whatever the artist was, you know, so and so likes this, okay, and it was part of the culture that I was in at the time. And
yeah,
you know, I've thought a little
well, and I think like you mentioned, like culture, I think is a really strong word here, because it means that like in each different kind of tour or touring community or like crew artist dynamic, there will be a specific culture. And like, I remember, you know, I'm sober. Mile, who I tour with normally, like doesn't use when we're touring or doesn't drink when we're touring really. Like he'll have a glass of wine. And then Bertrand, our drummer, was like coming from a kind of band, rock and roll background. And he was really excited to be on our tour because it was essentially like a clean, dry tour. Right. And it was different from the experiences that he'd had before, you know? And so I think that like, it was interesting to observe that like, even in the kind of micro dynamics, that it can create a very specific culture around drinking or drug use. And I imagine, especially if like your main social interaction for months at a time can be with a small group of people, that that would be, you know, something to be thoughtful about when you're either choosing to tour, whom to tour with, and like, what that's going to look like.
Yeah, and often it comes from the top down. So if you're touring in a group and the artist is sober, or all of the artists are sober, which I think is quite, I'm assuming that's quite rare, but say if it's Elton John who's sober, then it tends to be, I believe he has dry tours where, you know, there's a really big crew out on the road. Let's assume it's over 100 people. Who knows how many trucks and buses and stuff. But it's so the sort of guide there would be that there's in any workplace there's no alcohol around in the crew rooms, etc. Or I mean, I don't know how he does it in particular, but I know that some people will have no alcohol on the buses at all, but some people will say, okay, once you're back in the bus you can have a drink, but don't be hungover, don't let it affect you, you know, and no obvious drug use. Others are more flexible, but I think one of the difficulties with being sober on the road, and we do have some great, I'll just say there are some great services that specialise in things like passenger recovery. So I'm sure you've come across Chris Tate along your travels. So Chris is part of a service in Detroit that will arrange safe passage, which is kind of addiction terminology it's a bit obvious really, but that will help people get to 12-step meetings while they're passing through and they're at venues or, you know, they're working in studios awesome. There or something.
But this idea of, yeah, like kind of being thoughtful in advance about what a tour is going to look like. Because the next question was going to be like, if somebody's trying to get sober in the middle of a tour on the road, which I would not recommend, like, unless absolutely necessary. And then as somebody who's kind of practicing recovery, I would say that, like, if you're newly sober, it's important to prioritize that. And they say don't change a lot of things drastically in the first year. And going on tour would be like a lot of change a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder kind of if you had any wisdom on like best practices for like for instance, Chris Tate is an amazing resource, and what that might look like for people who felt like they couldn't get off the road.
Right. I would say, first of all, depending on, I would say consult a medical professional, just so that you, because sometimes there's some guidelines around how you get sober physically and the impact.
Yeah, withdrawal is
exactly.
A big deal.
Yeah, and understanding the impact of that. So we sometimes see that in the post-tour period as well, when people's lifestyle is changing. And sometimes we don't. People continue drinking at the same level that they have on tour, and then they realize that they've had a problem. But so I would say, first of all, consult the medical professional. Second, get some help, get some support, have a confidant, you know, whether that's a therapist, whether that's a sober coach, whether that is someone else on the road. You know, there might be somebody else who is sober or drinks a lot less or is more mindful around the way that they consume something. And then tell whoever your next in line is, you know, make somebody else aware. Look, this is what I want to do from now on, so that they can make some adjustments. So they can either get something, you know, a decent drink on the rider that is non-alcoholic if that's what you're in recovery from. So there's all sorts of, you know, because we want people to be able to celebrate and join in where they're comfortable to without feeling like they have to get involved. And so we want better alternatives than, I mean, water's great, right? But better alternatives than like water and Coke, we also, you know, want to think about. And there's loads of interesting stuff out there from, you know, kombuchas, and my favorite is sparkling tea. I love a sparkling tea. That's my new thing. LA Brewery, if you ever see it, it's so delicious.
And they have, that sounds fantastic.
They have it in a wild
we're looking for sponsors.
Yeah, well, oh my god, I tried to get them to sponsor the book launch actually, but couldn't get hold of them. But you know, some people have different views on CBD drinks and things like that, but that, you know, there's other stuff to look at. And I think really communicate very clearly where your boundaries are. One of the difficulties in getting sober on tour is the peer pressure. And that can,
totally.
And it's hard because, of course, you want to belong and fit in. And you don't necessarily want to, you know, people don't always feel very comfortable standing out. Some people take it very personally. If you stop drinking, they feel personally affronted or rejected by that.
Or judged, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like you're highlighting something in them. That's their stuff. You can't do anything about that apart from, you know, where possible, warmly and kindly, just, you know, taking yourself out of the situation. The other thing is stay busy. I would say, you know, get yourself something to do. So I used to smoke, and I smoked a lot, especially when I was in, you know, that was my coping mechanism, whether I was bored at a bus stop or whether I was, you know, at shows or whatever. And I, to begin with, I found something to do with my hands because I was very fidgety. So I was trying to find things to do. I was like, oh, should I try knitting? That's not really me. It's not really my thing. It was quite fun. But, you know, trying to realize, A, you know, when are your urges? So you kind of map out, you know, you can, I mean, this is work you can do with a therapist or a sober coach or a service. And there are services that run online recovery groups. Help Me Stop in London does an online. I mean, that might not work on tour, actually, because I think it's quite intense. I think you do stuff daily for about 5 weeks. But, you know, rehab doesn't have to be going somewhere. There's also, there are funds, various different, I'm not sure in France actually, we're hoping at some point to have a global resource database of services, sort of specialist services serving the music industry, including grants. So in the UK, there are some grants available, depending on various criteria for artists and for crew and for people working around live. So there is, I'm going to have to try and remember lots of names now, which is going to be a challenge. Help musicians, music support, we've got stagehand, backup tech, we've got Royal Society of Musicians of Great Britain. Sometimes they fund rehab if that's where you need to be.
Yeah, totally. I think Music Cares for the US is the spot for that. And France has really good public health care. So.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, good. And sweet relief in the States as well. And they have lots of state-specific stuff. So find out what's out there. Look at the 12-step meetings in your area. I mean, that's a great network as well that has loads of resources.
Yeah. And now, I mean, especially kind of post-COVID, the online recovery community is incredible and there's meetings everywhere all the time on the internet for free, obviously. And also I think that it's a good chance to plug. What was I going to plug? I forget. Oh, if you're a tour manager and if you're dealing with a population that might be sober, trying to get sober or sober curious, like just include the number for AA general service in the country that you're touring. And that's a 24-hour helpline, like with who will give you the information on the Alcoholics Anonymous or 12-step meetings in your community, which is
fantastic.
Really great, free. And like in recovery, we talk about like not trying not to get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired or halt, which seems like a kind of persistent and like inescapable state of being on tour.
Yes.
And I think that kind of exacerbated with like the dopamine roller coaster can be really challenging. So do you have any suggestions or what have you been your kind of observations and then, you know, practical wisdom for emotional regulation in a turbulent lifestyle?
Connection, I think, for me is personally very important, but it's something that I would try to encourage people to really invest as much as is possible, because it can be very limited on the road in relationships. So you have a source of, you know, a confidant that you can talk to. And there are lots of groups, as you say. There's the Back Lounge and stuff in music as well. Backline in the States for lots of recovery groups. Tonic Rider over here in the UK. But I think there's also lots of self-regulation stuff you can do. Some people really enjoy journaling, which kind of externalizes everything, gets it all out on the paper, on the page or on your phone, wherever you're writing. Grounding exercises can be very useful. They tend to be interoceptive, which focuses on processes in the body. So maybe things like a body scan, or stretching things out, or yoga or something like that stretches out the tension, or breath work is, using the, we call it kind of vagal regulation, or using, that's the theory around why extending your out breath in breath work helps to engage the parasympathetic nervous system and calm the body down. For some people, especially people who are highly anxious, actually focusing on sensations in the body, which you might do in a body scan, say, can actually increase their anxiety. It's a positive feedback loop. So for them, it's better to use exteroceptive, I think I'm pronouncing that right, might not be, techniques, which is focusing on things outside of the body. So one of the very popular grounding techniques uses your five senses, and it moves your focus to things outside of the body, and it grounds you in the here and now. That's one of the things that it does. So it helps you kind of bring the level of affect down. Also just recognizing and allowing for some different states. So one of the things that we do with people who are highly anxious is we're trying to build up an acceptance of a tolerable level of anxiety, because battling with the anxiety actually tends to make it 10 times worse. Judging the anxiety will make it 10 times worse. So it's something.
Or just kind of get it, trying to control it can get it really stuck, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And I think control is one of the things that flares up often on the road, because when you have reduced control in some areas, and you do often when you're touring, because lots of things is planned out, And you don't have the freedom to make as many choices. You have some choices you have to make on a daily basis. So some people experience reduced autonomy. Reduced autonomy impairs your mental health, well-being. You need to feel like you're in the driver's seat. So you might find that the areas where you do have control suddenly increase in importance. And what I would say is, you know, there's something about trying to accept that things will go wrong. Things are outside of your control. You know, it's like the serenity prayer, but, you know,
totally.
And just accepting that, you know, that what is within your control is how you're responding to it, how you're making time for yourself, you know, whether it's just having a walk outside of the venue or you're having a nap before you play, perhaps if it's a really late show, and eating something, really trying to take care of yourself. Now, ideally, when stress increases, we increase self-care as well, but of course that it's quite difficult to do. It may be going against what you want to do, which is
totally
indulge in something and self-soothe in a comforting way, and sometimes a little bit of that's okay, but it's like, is this really helping me beyond this exact moment,
this very second? Yeah, I mean, that's interesting though, because I also, like, I appreciated how you mentioned kind of you know, having communicating boundaries, but I think even just having kind of around recovery, if you're trying to stop drinking or using on tour, but even like very kind of specific boundaries around self-care, like for me, that's kind of par for the course with being a sober person in nightlife environments. Mm-hmm. And, but like, I think that again, kind of preventing states of hungry, angry, lonely, tired as much as possible. So as you said, like making sure that if I'm playing, you know, from 3 to 5 AM, I actually sleep for most of the evening and, you know, have a good meal and try and connect, like, just because otherwise you're kind of left in a, I don't ever want to put myself in a position where I feel really freaked out and desperate and don't have any resources. Like, I know at the airport, I'm not going to have that many resources for like grounding and feeling better. So I better kind of stockpile them so I don't show up in a place where I'm a little bit powerless for, you know, several hours. Yeah. Well-resourced and grounded and kind of not in a state of like sleeplessness, agitation, hunger, when I'm like, I can't find any food because they have no vegan food at the airport, you know, like having a meltdown, you know, because it will just make my life so much more difficult. And it's like, it's kind of a cruel thing to do to my body. So even if like I want to hang out with people, or even if I want to like, you know, stay awake instead of have a little nap, like I know that it definitely becomes kind of a long game, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have to forward plan, especially if you're touring and you're vegan, I would say, because so many places, I mean, some places are better than others, right? But so many places just don't cater for a good, balanced, you know, nutrition.
No. And like, if you are an artist, be as specific as you can possibly be on your rider, because like, they are trying, like, if this is your home away from home, then they, you know, kind of theoretically should be able to provide for you the things that you need to function.
And maybe alternating, having different riders. Like I remember a good friend of mine, Woody. So Woody used to work at ATP and Rock Feedback over here. And we did a show together. I think it was, I was booking a venue at the time, and we worked on a show together, and we started thinking about pulling the riders together. And I told him what I was going to get, and he was like, no, we need to think about, you know, I think what would be better would be this. And he helped me from, I remember that moment really clearly, because I realized then I'd been thinking about it like I was just putting on a party, rather than this person, you know, this group of people is, you know, they've been on the road for several weeks, they're knackered, they need to feed their body, they might like a little bit of something nice, but they also, you know, they might be more appreciative of, you know, this was an artist who didn't specify their rider, actually. So one thing I might think about then with artists going out on the road is, if you've got a specific rider and you've got a few shows in a row, maybe alternate it, just for variety as well as anything.
That's a good idea.
But for nutrition.
And also, like, you can even put a sandwich on your rider for the next day.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, think, like, be kind to your future self.
Yeah, like, good idea. Yeah.
And I wonder, like, you know, kind of circling back to relationships, but I think even generally, like, within mental health, I think we hear about entry or exit friction, right? Of, like, the challenges of, like, leaving and then coming home, and how kind of that can really screw with your equilibrium. And I wonder how to kind of, if you have any suggestions for managing that friction, like the come down of tour and then the ramping up or anxiety of leaving.
Yeah. I think making space for it and naming it is the first step, you know, anticipating that before you leave and when you come back, there's periods of adjustment. And that brings up some stuff for people around what the impact is to the relationship, because it causes a little bit of turbulence. You know, coming back or meeting people out on the road can come with so much expectation, can be so disappointing when actually the connection you're desperate for isn't there in the way that you want it to be. You're missing each other, you have different needs, or someone's distracted, or they're in a state of kind of recovering, or actually you're disrupting their routine by coming back in some particular way. Whatever the issues are for your relationship, you know, bring them out, make space, try not to get defensive. You know, this is about making space for both persons' experience and navigating through that. These cycles of separation and reunion can take a toll. But, you know, we also saw in the pandemic that lots of relationships, or some, I should stop sort of exaggerating, but some relationships on the road where one person toured an awful lot, suddenly both people were at home and the relationship really struggled because they had, mm-hmm. you know, what was normal for them was to have these periods where, you know, their relationship had a certain amount of space that was then lost, as well as the challenges to identity, income stream, et cetera, that also came with it. So it's kind of finding what works for your relationship and keep checking in with each other, you know?
Yeah. And I think especially because it can be such an inconsistent line of work, like those are very good practices regardless, right? Because like eventually you'll have to adjust, you know, whether you're kind of in an album cycle or in a more of a production mode, right? That it's like, it can be drastically different lifestyle rhythms, and that can be really disruptive to relationships. So how to kind of navigate those in the most, I wouldn't say frictionless, because I think friction is inevitable, but the most kind of generous and loving way possible.
Right. And, you know, being attentive, there are times where it's helpful for the relationship to be the priority. And that can be hard when someone's job is so absorbing and 24/7, you know, it's very hard for the other person sometimes to feel prioritized or like they're the front and center. And thinking it as well about relationships with children there for people who tour, who have kids, you know, that can be really tricky, especially if you're missing significant events. And so there are, you know, one of the things that was really encouraging about doing the research for the book was just how creative people got with keeping the erotic flame alive, or by leaving each other notes at different venues. If both people toured and they had they were both going to the same venue at different times, or, you know.
Aww.
Yeah, I thought that was so sweet.
So romantic.
I know, it's lovely, isn't it? Or there was, you know, Taylor Hanson was talking about how, and he's got loads of kids, he's got like 7 kids or something, and his wife, they make sure that they have a strong presence of him at home in terms of things that are given or gifted to a child or gifted from both of them. So there's a sense that, you know, dad's thinking of you, we've done this together. Mm. And you know, taking perhaps if somebody's been doing the lion's share of the load at home, then, you know, thinking about taking more of that when you come back and things like that. Just, you know, being a bit more sort of attentive and sensitive and thoughtful.
No, that sounds really like useful and helpful, because I think especially when there's so much stuff to think about and organize and plan and, you know, create, that it can be very easy to kind of take a relationship for granted or just like not put the time into kind of considering. Like, I know I can kind of default into kind of inconsiderate behavior, just like I don't think about my actions or how they might affect my partner. And so this idea of like, what does consideration look like for your significant other, or even like the friendship group that you're coming back to, when it can be quite, you know, disruptive to like leave and come back and leave and come back and leave and come back, because people can't really rely on you, you know, like how do you consider other people's feelings when it can be very easy to become very, very self-centered.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And recognizing, like I interviewed a production manager, I think he is, production director, something like that, called Opie, and I interviewed him and his wife. So he works with huge, huge artists, Rolling Stones, blah, 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 you know, AC/DC, that kind of level. And they were talking about how when they're on tour, the relationship goes into a different mode. And if he's in a high state of stress, then Simone, his wife, has more of a supportive role at that point. But they've talked about it extensively. So they've understood that, you know, actually, we're in a way, we're both going out on the road, that this, he's able to do what he does because there is the support of her. But her, the decisions that they make together, they make, you know, for the relationship. So, and he also says a lot about, you know, don't disrupt the routine of the person at home when you get back, you know, respect that and try and seamlessly adjust, you know, if that person's still going out and doing things, and, you know, it's, that's good. That's part of them having their separateness. That is not necessarily a rejection of you, but life does go on, you know.
Yeah, as it must.
Yes. Yes.
No, that's. I love that you name that, because I think it can be, there can be this expectation of like, I'm back.
Right.
Like, pay attention to me.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily helpful, and it can be quite annoying to whoever's been like, yeah, I have a life also.
Yes.
So winding down. What's next? What are you excited about? What are you working on?
Oh, I'm very excited about a break. I'm going to take August off.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I want to turn the book into an online course platform with, you know, videos and animation and things. We need some sponsors for that. So we will start looking for sponsors. And then, I mean, in the immediate sense, I'm going to Roskilde this weekend and Woo! MITC. So I run a group called MITC, Music Industry Therapist Collective. We're all ex-industry psychologists, psychotherapists. We've got a medical doctor, and we run. So we've just set up this new initiative called MITC Soundcheck, where we have backstage workshops, breathwork workshops, you know, injury prevention, stress management, anxiety relief, and one-to-one consultation with therapists, psychologists, medical doctor, physiotherapy, and they're all getting a copy of the book. Well, this is the emerging artists area for the first 3 days of the festival. So yeah, really looking forward to that.
Congratulations. Thank That's you. so cool that you're actually like putting the resources into available action. Like, so awesome.
Thank
Congratulations.
You. Thanks. Yeah.
Aw. I'm like, I want to be an emerging artist in Roskilde so I can go like hang out with a therapist.
Yeah.
And if people want to know more about you and your work, before we just end into the lightning round to end on a kind of effervescent note, where can people find you?
On the socials, I am at Tamsin Embleton on most of them. I think it's something else on Facebook, annoyingly, actually. I think it's like two or something else. Who knows?
Facebook is evil. Ignore it.
Yeah, I'm less and less time on Facebook, actually. And we're also at We Are MITC. The website is musicindustrytherapist.com, and I'm embletonpsychotherapy.com. And yeah, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
Awesome. And if people want to buy the book, where they can buy it on any place that sells books?
They can, yeah. So they can.
Ah!
So in the UK, Rough Trade, Waterstones, Amazon globally. If you sign up to our newsletter, actually, we're just about to send one out. We've got 20. We can only do discounts in the UK, annoyingly, because it's distributed by other people externally. But 20% off the book for a single copy, 25% for more than five copies. Through our newsletter, and you can sign up for that on musicindustrytherapist.com or touringmanual.com. That's the website, actually. That is the one. So that's got lots of our resources. It's got a free chapter on fear of flying you can download.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Woo! That's awesome. Well, I hope that people actually, like, you know, go to the website and check it out, because I think it's a really, really powerful resource. And obviously, by nature of my jobby job, that we have a lot of people who are in the music industry and touring professionals listening. So check it out. And so we descend into the lightning round. Don't think too hard. Speak from your heart. Oh. If you're uncomfortable with the question, say pass.
Okay. Oh,
what's your favorite snack?
Corn. I like those baked corn things.
Just like corn on the cob, raw.
Yeah.
My fave. What is a song that pumps you up?
Oh, Promised Land. Joe, what's his face? Do you know the one I mean? Take me to the promise. You know the one?
Yes. So good.
Such a banger.
I love that song.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da,
yeah.
It's a banger. People check it out. What turns you on? And that can be either sexually or it can be kind of like intellectually, creatively, like what do you feel excited about and get a charge by?
I'm not very quick at answering this, am I? I guess just playfulness, you know, playfulness. I think you feel safe when you're playing, you know, and I think it's a creative state of mind. So when people are silly and surreal and playful, that's good for me.
I like that. Yeah, especially because you're kind of like light up when you think about it. That's really nice. What is your favorite way to downregulate if you're feeling anxious or stressed?
Well, nature. I think for me, I've started watching things like Spring Watch, which I think is a sign of my old age. But
what is Spring Watch? It's an American. We don't have that. I'm so curious.
It's in the UK. Basically, they go to a national park and they have cameras on like little birds' nests and things. And you watch the life cycle of these animals. It's just really beautiful, really calming. I think I find nature very, very soothing. Are you okay?
I'm trying to mute because my partner just got home and him and the dog are having like a reunion. You hear him screaming like, Raya, Raya.
Oh, that's adorable.
But that, I mean, I moved to the countryside so I could also do a spring watch, but it's year round.
Nice.
And it is very soothing.
Yeah.
And finally, last question, what do you love?
Oh, it's a bit cheesy, but my partner, I call him Cheekbones, my partner, he's...
That's not cheesy, that's beautiful.
My God. I know, he's wonderful. I feel like he's brought so much to my life. It's, so him.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. It's so nice to catch up with you, James, and I'm really like so impressed by the work that you do. So thank you for taking the time a second time.
Thank you. And I'm really glad we got to do it again. It's awesome.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth, sober, sex, all of this and more. Sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth, sober, sex, you'll never get